Let's continue with our look at Jesus' triumphal entry on the 10th day of the first Jewish month, the day on which Passover lambs were designated. Jesus is going to be arriving at Jerusalem on this day prophetically as the priest, the king, and the Passover lamb all rolled into one. The disciples and others don't quite understand that that's what's happening until later. But we know that Jesus was at Bethany overnight, and then he went with his apostles from Bethany to Bethphage, which is only about half of a mile. Bethphage is right on the eastern side of the crest of the Mount of Olives. So Jesus picks up a donkey colt, about a year old animal, that's never been ridden before. His apostles collect it in a special supernatural way. They bring mama donkey as well. And they put their cloaks on the back of the yearling in order for Jesus to use as a saddle. And then Jesus begins riding the road from Bethphage up and over the crest of the Mount of Olives. And in the process, the word has shot out that Jesus is on his way. And everybody down in Jerusalem that's interested in Jesus, whether they have a passing interest or some sort of invested interest in him, they start rushing out to greet Jesus along the road. It's about another 3/4 of a mile, I think, from the top of the Mount of Olives down across the Kidron Valley and then up into the area of Jerusalem where the Pool of Bethesda is located. The Temple Mount is just to the south of that area. But the pilgrims would always go to the pool areas first so that they could immerse themselves before proceeding up to the Temple Mount. So the probably tens of thousands of people are now lining this road, waiting for a glimpse of this special celebrity that they either have heard before or they've heard about. And what do they do? Luke's account, Luke 19:35, says, as he rode along, they spread their cloaks on the road. Now, I told you that more than likely, a similar thing had happened in the morning of this day as the high priest brought his Passover lamb from Bethlehem to Jerusalem on the south side, where the pilgrims would gather and they would throw soft objects like palm fronds and stuff in front of the lamb and in front of the high priest. And some of them would throw their clothing there, probably as a way of having a souvenir. You know, my coat got stepped on by the high priest and his Passover lamb, that sort of thing. And they were singing the songs that morning from Psalm 118, Hoshiagna, save us now, to the lamb. And then they were singing, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, about the high priest. Well, now, probably in the afternoon, we're talking about, that same sort of parade mindset has taken place on the east side. And the people have cut branches off of palm trees. They've cut things out of the fields as well, because that's soft vegetation material, little sheaves of unripe or almost ripe barley, probably. And they throw those in front of Jesus and his donkey, but they're also throwing their clothes down there for the same reason, probably, so that they could have special connection afterwards. But here is what happens as they peek over the top of the Mount of Olives and the city of Jerusalem comes into full view. And you have to understand how significant that is for a Jewish person. You've got the temple taking up most of the room in this panorama. And in the center of the Temple Mount, there is this great big tall building. It's got a tower on the front that's 180 feet tall. It's white limestone as the main building stone, but it has gold highlights everywhere. The white stone theme and the gold highlight theme is all around in the courts and in the porticos and in the walls. And it's one person, Josephus, said that for some people it felt like when they first came up over the top of this hill and saw the buildings glimmering in the sunlight, it was as if they were looking at a mountain on fire. Now, when the Jewish pilgrims saw this, no matter how many times they'd seen it before, they celebrated. They got happy. And having been to Jerusalem a few times now, I always look forward to coming out of the tunnel, because that's the way we do it, and being able to look off to my left through the windows of the bus and see the Temple Mount area. And it always makes me happy. And we always read, or at least I try to make sure we always read from the Psalms about being how excited it is to be coming to the house of the Lord. And so this is the sort of excitement that we're talking about here that takes hold of the crowd. Luke 19:37. As he was drawing near, already on the way down the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of his disciples began to rejoice and praise God with a loud voice for all the mighty works they had seen, saying, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven, glory in the highest." Luke doesn't use Hosanna, but that's part of what they're saying as well. Now, verse 39 reports that some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, rebuke your disciples." So they don't like the fact that Jesus is being treated as Messiah, as the prophesied king. In fact, you know, remember that these guys have already put out the order that anyone that verbalizes that should be kicked out of the synagogues, because they feel that that's an overreach. And so here they try publicly to shame Jesus into acknowledging he isn't the fulfillment of those passages, and that he needs to make sure that his disciples shut their mouths and don't say these blasphemous things. But he answered, "I tell you, if these were silent, the very stones would cry out." Now, when I was growing up and hearing this story, I thought we were talking about stones on the ground, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about all those massive stones that make up the Temple Mount and the Temple Building and the Temple Complex and the city of Jerusalem. All those majestic stones. Many of them are less than 40 years old, because Herod the Great is the one that renovated the temple less than 50 years old. About 47 years ago or so, he rebuilt all of this stuff with very large stones, some of them weighing hundreds of tons. And so he's talking about the whole temple complex itself. Even the city of Jerusalem would have to start bearing testimony about who he is if the people didn't do so. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that just wonderful? Since I'm thinking about it, if you've ever thought about going to Jerusalem, if you've ever thought about going to the Holy Land, remember that we've got a trip coming up in October. And I would love for you to be part of the group where we experience all this sort of stuff firsthand. We will walk down from the Mount of Olives into the Kidron Valley, and we will have that panoramic view of the city of Jerusalem. It doesn't look exactly like it did in Jesus' day, but it's still an amazing experience to do that walk and to see that laying out in front of you. Go to the website, intotheword.net. On the front page, you'll see the countdown clock. Just below that, you'll see the brochure hot link. Go ahead and click on that. So back to the text now. Verse number 41. when he drew near and saw the city, he wept over it. So while everybody else is yelling in joy, leaping up and down in celebration, having a praise event in their life, Jesus, coming over that hill, looks down at the city of Jerusalem, particularly at the Temple Mount, I think, and he sees it prophetically destroyed. He sees what's coming in less than 40 years, in AD 70. And this is what he says. And only a few of the apostles apparently heard this. Would that you, even you, had known on this day the things that make for peace. Now you need to understand that the word for peace here, and in most contexts I think in Scripture, is not about the absence of open warfare. Peace is about relationship, the way it's supposed to be. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. All of us have gone out of relationship with God. We are not at peace. And so Jesus says to the city of Jerusalem, to the people represented by that city, if you only understood what it's going to require for there to be peace, the only way that peace is going to come is through the death of Jesus, through his atoning sacrifice, for his laying down his life. That's what he's referencing here. But then he goes on, but now they are hidden from your eyes. Now remember, he's crying this stuff out. This is his heart broken over what has already happened and what it's going to take to fix it. And even then, it's not going to be fixed for everyone, because you have to embrace the offer of salvation. And if you don't, then judgment is all that remains. In the book of Daniel, chapter number 9, which has the countdown clock to the coming of the Messiah, it says that in the midst of that 70th prophetic week, that is, that 70th sabbatical cycle, in the midst of it, the Messiah will be cut off without reason. He'll be executed without a justified reason. That's exactly what's going to happen to Jesus. He is going to be executed by the Roman and Jewish authorities in tandem. They won't have a reason to do it. They'll just do it. And then it goes on in that passage to say that the city of Jerusalem and the temple will be destroyed along with the Messiah. Their fate is tied up with his fate. Because he is destroyed, they will be destroyed. That's what Daniel chapter number 9 says. And so Jesus describes that here. For the days will come upon you when your enemies will set up a barricade around you and surround you and hem you in on every side. And that's exactly what the Romans will do in AD 70 against the rebels who have seized control of the Temple Mount and some of the important parts of the city of Jerusalem. The Romans will cordon off the entire area. And then they will start building siege ramps up in order to take the place down. Verse 44, they will tear you down to the ground, you and your children within you. 1.1 million Jews died in the months, the early months of AD 70. That's the last siege time for the Jewish war at Jerusalem. And another 100,000 of them end up going into exile and or to be used in the different gladiatorial games around the eastern end of the Roman Empire. and Jerusalem ends up being dismantled. The only thing that was left, other than foundational walls and things, the only intact structures were three towers and the walls in between them that were part of the Herodian palace complex on the west side of the city. The rest of it was knocked down. And so Jesus is predicting that devastation level already. Then he goes on and he says this, and this is true about the temple. And they will not leave one stone upon another in you, because you did not know the time of your visitation. When we visit the Temple Mount, you can actually see ground level for the original Temple Mount of Herod's temple and of Jesus' day by the perimeter walls, especially on the western side, what is referred to as the Western Wall, sometimes the Wailing Wall, where the Jewish people gather. You can see ground level because above that line, there are no Herodian stones. They just stop because all of the Herodian stones up on the main ground level of the Temple Mount were taken down and either shoved off into the valley below or carted off to be reused somewhere else. Nothing original of the temple complex was left when the Romans were done with their dismantling work in AD 70. And Jesus predicted that. And these words that he uses here will come up again a couple of days later, because the apostles can't handle this idea of thinking about the temple being destroyed, and they ask him about it. But Jesus here makes the point that all of this is going to happen because you do not know the time of your visitation. The word visitation here points back to the Greek Old Testament and therefore to the wording of the original Jewish sacred texts, that when God came to check you out, that was your day of visitation, to see whether or not you were to be rewarded or judged. And so the coming of the Messiah is the ultimate time of visitation. Jesus is the way, the truth, the life. No one comes to the Father except by or through him. He is the pivot point. He is the decision point. And so because too many of these folks at Jerusalem in this generation rejected Jesus as Messiah, the city of Jerusalem and the temple at Jerusalem were both destroyed. And so we will keep that in mind when we come to the Olivet Discourse later. Now, I want to go back to John's Gospel at this point, because there's some commentary there that I don't want us to miss out on. So John chapter 12, and it says in verse 16, about the whole riding on the donkey and the things being shouted. His disciples did not understand these things at first, but when Jesus was glorified, then they remembered that these things had been written about him and had been done to him. Verse 17, the crowd that had been with him when he called Lazarus out of the tomb and raised him from the dead continued to bear witness. So on this day of Jesus' entry, you've got people saying, you see him? I was there the day he resurrected Lazarus from the dead after 4 days in that tomb. I saw Lazarus come hopping out of that tomb, bound up in his grave clothes. I saw him being removed from those grave clothes and being alive again. He did that. So these folks are bearing witness as to the power of Jesus and bringing even more faith in him being the fulfillment of the Messiah. Now, you remember how the Pharisees responded to the whole Lazarus thing. They've got a hit order out on him, They'd like to kill him because of this sort of testimony being offered on his behalf. Now, verse 18, the reason why the crowd went to meet him was that they heard he had done this sign. So we'd talked about that earlier. A lot of these people came pouring out to the east side of Jerusalem along the road because they'd heard about Jesus resurrecting Lazarus from the dead. Now the Pharisees, when they see all this happen, the Pharisees said to one another, "You see what that we're gaining nothing. You're gaining nothing. Look, the world has gone after him." So they are not happy that they're not making a dent in the relationship between Jesus and these crowds, these Passover crowds. How strong is it? Well, let's look at Matthew's account. Matthew 21:10 says that when he entered Jerusalem, the whole city was stirred up saying, "Who is this?" Now, Jesus is coming in on the northeast corner of the city of Jerusalem at this time period, into the area around the Pool of Bethesda by the Sheep Gate area. And then from there, he can go south into the temple complex itself. But there's a lot more of the city to the south and off to the west. And so Jesus coming in on the northeast is raising such a ruckus that it can be heard clear over on the west side and clear over on the south side. And they're all going, "What's that? What's that going on over there?" And some of them might be close enough to see Jesus wondering who he is, because not everybody did know. Remember, there's a lot of visitors here that are coming from out of country. And so, who is this? And the crowds were saying, "This is the prophet Jesus from Nazareth of Galilee." So Jesus is the talk of the town on this, the 10th day of the first Jewish month, the day when the Passover lambs are being designated. Now, I've said a couple of times now that Jesus seems to be coming in on the afternoon. Here's my reason for saying that. Mark chapter number 11, verse number 11. He entered Jerusalem and went into the temple. And when he looked around at everything, as it was already late, he went out to Bethany with the 12. So he came into the northeast corner, then went south into the temple complex itself, would have squeezed his way through the crowd, because remember, we've got a couple of 100,000 plus that jammed in at one time, probably, in the courts of the temple. He would have gone around in places where he could have seen the ending of the day of business of the traders. Remember the people who, for convenience sake originally, were selling sheep and doves and pigeons for sacrifices to the people who have come in from out of town, and who also are doing exchanges of Gentile coinage, which often had images on them, for Jewish temple coinage, which did not have human images or animal images on them, because you didn't want to put a Gentile coin into the holy treasury. Now, the problem was that against Jewish regulations, they were charging a fee for changing these coins. And some of that fee was then going into the pockets of the temple authorities. The sellers of the animals were charging inflated prices for the animals. And then some of that inflated price was going into the pockets of the leading priests of the temple complex. And so all of that cheating that was going on, Jesus would have seen the tail end of that again on this day. He had cleared out these things 3 years earlier, but they are back in full force again. And so guess what he's going to do the next day when he comes back? That's right. He's going to clear the temple out again. So that's what we're looking forward to in the story tomorrow. Now, in the 2 minutes we've got left, let me remind you again that Jesus is not staying at Jerusalem. He is staying at the house in Bethany that belongs to Simon, the former leper, and Martha, along with Mary and Lazarus living there. So he is going to make a mile and a half trek back and forth each day of Passover week. So it takes him like 20, 30 minutes in order to do this trek, probably. And so he is going to walk by a fig tree in the morning. And he'll be hungry and he'll want to eat from it. And he will not find figs on it. And he'll end up cursing it. And so these are the things that we're looking forward to seeing in the story that's coming next. So what I want you to do is mark your place, Matthew 21:12, Mark 11:12, Luke 19:45, and always keep John chapter 12 ready to go as well, because these are the passages that we'll get back to tomorrow when we resume this story. I want to apologize to you that this is kind of like trying to take a drink out of a fire hose. There's just so much information that we're pouring together here of what Jesus was doing in this last week. But these are important things, and we need to get them under our belt, and I think it will help us appreciate even more what happens on the day of his death, and also what happens on the day of his glorious resurrection, when all of these people find out that prophecies have been fulfilled in front of their very eyes.